Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show features my candid conversation with LGBTQIA+ activist and advocate, Judy Shepherd. We discuss the tragic loss of her son, Matthew, and how Judy and her husband, Dennis, turned their pain into purpose by starting the Matthew Shepherd Foundation. Judy and Dennis carry on their son's legacy by embracing human dignity and celebrating diversity. This episode is incredibly powerful, and I hope it will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest, Judy Shepherd, suffered an unimaginable loss. On October 6, 1998, Judy's son Matthew, a gay college student attending the University of Wyoming, was approached by two men and lured into their truck. After beating, robbing, and torturing Matthew, the two men tied Matthew to a buck rail fence and left him to die. After an agonizing 18 hours, Matthew was finally found and taken to a local hospital in Laramie. Barely alive, Matthew had fallen into a coma and had to be transferred to a more advanced trauma ward in Fort Collins, Colorado. After a six-day battle for his life, Matthew unfortunately passed away on October 12, 1998, at the age of 21. But during those 6 days, the world watched and the world stood vigil. While Matthew's assailants were motivated by their hatred for the gay community, federal hate crime laws at the time did not protect members of the LGBT community. In the years following Matthew's death, Judy and Dennis Shepherd campaigned to Congress to expand federal hate crime legislation to include sexual orientation so what happened to Matthew would never happen again. Over 10 years after Matthew Shepherd's tragic death, President Obama signed the Matthew Shepherd and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. It expanded federal hate crime laws to include crimes motivated by a victim's gender, sexual identity, orientation, or disability. Judy has received countless awards for her work advocating for the LGBTQIA+ community and remains an ardent activist fighting on the front lines of the war against hate. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Judy Shepherd.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ellen DeGeneres.
Well, just when they thought I'd shut up. I am so pissed off. I can't stop crying. You know, I mean, I know we all feel the same way, and I'm here, and I'm, you know, he's got his two close friends here, and I don't even know him, and I'm thinking this is just really selfish of me. I mean, what, pull yourself together, and it just hit me why I am so devastated by it. It's because this is what I was trying to stop. This is exactly why I did what I did. Boy, you see them come out in forces when they think a lesbian's going to be on television, and the preachers come out then, but, you know, something like this happens, where are they? Matthew Shepherd wasn't hurting anyone. He was a good person, a gentle soul who was tortured to death. He's with God now, who I'm sure is crying. My torture goes on every time I think of what those boys did to him, just because he was gay. When will we learn? Just because someone's black, just because someone's Jewish, just because someone's gay. This is a war. We need your help. Please search your hearts. Think for yourselves. Be on the right side, the side of love and compassion. Thank you very much.
As an educator, I look for these stories from storytellers to help teachers and those they humbly serve try to make sense out of things that don't make sense. Try to allow people to know that sometimes it's okay to not be okay. And as a teacher, when I learned
of the horrific hate crime that was bestowed on Matthew Shepard. I never expected to meet the parents. Judy and Dennis Shepard have become advocates and activists and political pundits, where they pack a punch trying to change the laws of our country, if not the world, to allow people to have a place in society, to love how they want to love, to live how they want to live. And so meeting Judy and Dennis Shepard was one of those pinch me moments. So to be able to introduce our incredible audience to someone who is on the cutting edge of making things better for humanity is such a gift and such an honor and so humbling. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce all of you to someone who may be short in stature, but is a giant that we can all stand on her shoulders. And that would be Judy Shepard. Thank you for joining us, Judy.
Gosh, Erin, I hope I can live up to that delightfully humbling introduction. Thank you.
You're welcome. And I mean that and more. I think every time I've been in your presence, whether it was in an audience where you're on a stage or in a movie theater, when your incredible films about your son have been showed to the world, watching on my television when you've done political events, I just weep. So I have a feeling that our audience may do the same today, and I hope they do. So what is it like to be an ordinary person who has commanded an extraordinary stage, and that stage is global?
To be honest, I can't think of it in those terms. I am an ordinary person given extraordinary opportunity that I would get back in a heartbeat to have Matt back. But this is something that just happened to us that we didn't seek out. I don't think it's changed us other than made us more aware of the things around us and that we have a voice. But in all reality, we all have that voice. Mm. It's just who's given the opportunity to use it. We can all use it whenever we want, but we've been handed a larger opportunity, I guess. And we're doing it for Matt and his friends and, you know, his community, thinking maybe we could change some hearts and minds. When Matt passed 20 plus years ago, we sure didn't think we'd still be that voice now, 20 years later. People have a tendency to move on. The fact that Matt's story has hung on is still a touchstone and unfortunately is still relevant is at the same time heartbreaking, infuriating, frustrating, but it gives us the opportunity to talk about Matt all the time, which is lovely.
Absolutely. And, you know, in the Freedom Rider world, there's icons that I found that we could talk about an Anne Frank and it would really lead to humanity. Talking about a Matthew Shepard leads to humanity. So for our younger audience who may be exposed to the story for the first time and listening to you or watching you is going to want them to read and listen and learn more, tell us about your beautiful son, Matt, prior to this tragedy, before you had that stage and that extraordinary opportunity to recount his life. Let's go back to when he was just a beautiful boy growing up in Wyoming, where you are today.
Right. So Matt was small in stature. He was 5'2 and weighed 110 on a good day. He smoked too much. He drank too much coffee. He was a college student when we lost him, 21. I would not have wanted my life at 21 to be memorialized forever. He's never been given the chance to grow into who he could have become. He loved the theater. He loved to debate. He was a great talker. Everything new was amazing to Matt. He did not understand at all the tendency that people have to categorize other people or stereotype other people. To Matt, people were just people. Nothing about them other than their uniqueness made them different to Matt. He just saw another person struggling to live their life. My mother even commented when he was 4 years old that the empathy he showed for other people was beyond her understanding. Mm. Now, my mother was not particularly empathetic. She grew up in a different time. Women had a different place in her time. So, you know, it was a new world to her. But Matt did have the opportunity to come out to her, which I was very worried about because she was a bit of a bigot, but she was okay with it. She said to me afterwards, "I don't understand why people think that being gay is like wrong. I don't understand. It's just a person." And then later I said, "So Mom, can Matt bring his boyfriend over?" She goes, "No, Meeting Matt was fine. That was enough. But Matt's Matt, and I don't really need to meet anymore. That was beyond her her capability. So Matt was all about social change, justice, equality, the environment, all the things that we're, you know, young people are dealing with today was his avenue. He never met anybody that was a stranger. He felt like he knew them immediately. He just loved people. And he smiled with his whole body. Every mother says their smile could light up a room. That was true with Matt, but his whole body smiled. He couldn't hide his emotions very well. He did go through times of being, I'm not sure what to call it really, but there were times when he was not quite sure of himself, who he was. He struggled with that. I don't know how long he struggled with being gay and not wanting to talk about it, because he didn't come out to us until he was 18.
What I loved about meeting Michelle, who made that Emmy award-winning documentary about your son's life, Matthew Shepard is a friend of mine. What I loved about Michelle and the cast of characters that she was able to gather that were his friends, it showed a part of his life that a lot of people don't know about him going to school in Switzerland, about you as a family moving to Saudi Arabia for a moment in time. So for the young folks who don't know that he had this rich life in other continents and other countries, what was that like for a young boy from Wyoming to find himself in Saudi Arabia and Switzerland and to travel the world with this really unique school that he had the opportunity to go to in high school?
Well, we purposely went to Saudi thinking that this would be an opportunity for both our boys to expand their horizon, to know that life existed outside their backyard in Wyoming. Logan was only 12, so this was not an opportunity he was looking forward to, but Matt definitely was. And he tried to explain to people that going to boarding school was a plus, not a negative in one's life. When we dropped him off at Switzerland, it was a very old building. And I remember looking at me like, are you really going to leave me here with nobody that I know and nothing that is familiar? That lasted about a week, you know, until he got to know what was expected of him. He loved every minute of it. The travel was expansive. However, there was this one thing about Matt that if anything was going to go wrong on a trip, it was going to happen to Matt. Lose his passport, suitcase get lost, suitcase break, backpack stolen, anything go wrong, it would happen to Matt. His friends, they were great at taking care of him and getting him through those trying times. But his whole world expanded on meeting other students from around the world. The company sent him to school, not us, right? So everybody else was there on their parents' dime, and so they had money to spend. He did not have that kind of money to spend, which was a little bit dismaying for him to not feel like on equal footing with them.
I'm glad you said that, because I found that with the Freedom Riders, when they were afforded these amazing opportunities to go off to college, a lot of them got scholarships, and they'd find themselves in a college in Massachusetts, and everyone's going to go to the Cape for the weekend or the Hamptons, and my students couldn't even afford to call home. You know, so it's hard when you are not running with the fast crowd with the resources. So for those that don't know, the company that your husband worked for was in the oil industry, and how did... Was that connected to what he was doing in Wyoming prior to you leaving?
Dennis is a safety engineer for a oil drilling company and was recruited to go to Saudi Arabia to work for Saudi Aramco. We lived on a compound in Saudi, 16,000 other folks. It was like a piece of Southern California set down in the Saudi Arabia, in the eastern province on the Persian Gulf. So it was not totally un-American to live there. Everything was very familiar, but so many employees were from the Western world. The company didn't really want young people to bring their ideas to their own culture, right? So they sent students outside of the country to any boarding school in the world that they wanted to go to, all the Western students. So Matt chose to go to Switzerland. Our other son chose to go to Minnesota because he was tired of living overseas. So, you know, they were completely different in their outlook on life. And it was fun to talk to stories about that. But Matt loved living in Europe. There was just something very unique about it that he never would have gotten to experience otherwise.
You know, I'm interested because I know you've traveled the world extensively, and I have as well. And some of the countries I've gone to in the Middle East are not as inclusive to the LGBTQIA community. I remember I did an event in Dubai, and I deliberately took a rainbow flag with me. And someone said that could be really controversial and taboo and political in Dubai. But we were supposed to make this beautiful collage when we got there, and I wanted it to be part of my collage. My assumption is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the Saudi government would not have embraced Matthew if he had come out to you while he was on the compound. And do you think that might have had something to do with him not coming out till much later at 18?
Well, you're correct. Saudi is even much more strict on that point than some of the other Middle Eastern countries. I have a feeling Dubai wouldn't have been as challenging as Saudi. But Matt only lived in Saudi one summer,
okay.
The first summer before school started. So the influence of the government there would not have, in all honesty, would not have played a bigger role in his decision than the televangelists in the U.S. during the same time period, who were on TV all the time telling folks how bad it was to be gay and we should all put them on an island and or stone them or whatever. Their rhetoric was just as harmful as anything he would have heard in Saudi. In fact, in Saudi, it wasn't even discussed, but it also wasn't something they watched for unless someone was soliciting, you know, on the street. They weren't looking for it to happen. It's just part of their cultural rhetoric and still is.
He's beautiful. And I'm going to refer to him as an is. I'm an English teacher, and I think tenses are really important. So I feel like in everything that you do, Matthew is very present and very intentional. So I'm going to use is as much as I can rather than was, because I know you feel him at every moment of every day. When Matthew was a child, and although he did not come out until he was 18, was there a motherly intuition that he was gay and that you were just waiting for him to come to you so that you could be accepting?
Well, that's exactly what it was like, Erin. I can't put words to it. It was mother's instinct, totally. I had many gay friends in college. It was going to be fine with me, but I also knew Matt. I knew that if I approached him about it, he would retreat. He would not have been receptive to that at all. He had to be ready, and he had to be ready to talk about it. And we made it very clear that it would never be an unwelcoming home. I talked about the gay community in a very positive way, as much as it was a thing in the 90s, because it wasn't even really a top discussion in the 90s, right? It was still very much a secret society, other than the AIDS pandemic and the occasional news article about pride parades. It was just not a topic of discussion. But I made it clear that it was that I would be accepting no matter what, that we all, the family would be.
I think what I love about your family is that although there's a stereotype or a perception about a cowboy, which Dennis clearly is, there's this tenderness of your husband that melts me. And I love that in this world of oil and cowboys and the West, that there's this father figure who was so inviting and open. And I just think that says a lot about you as a wife, to pick someone like that to be your life partner who would be as open as you are.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I actually knew that when we were married. I have to be honest with you, I'm not sure I would have known that even through our life until what happened to Matt. He was accepting of Matt. Of course he was. Matt's our son. That was never going to be a question. But when Matt passed and Dennis saw how other young people in particular, well, not even that, anybody in the gay community who had faced rejection, it just broke his heart. He was just crushed that would be a deciding factor in anyone's respect or love for anyone else. And I think it opened him up even more to the idea that not everyone is like him, that there are those out there who pick up on differences and amplify them in a negative way. He's never been like that. It's always been about taking care of other people who might need help. That's the way he was raised, and that's the way he lived his life. But when it happened in his family, it became a bigger deal.
There's a scene in the documentary about the night that Dennis goes back to get the rabbit and bring it to the hospital. And that's what I think about, is the quintessential Dennis moment of in that like mania, that tenderness. I love that, using that word specifically for men when they are like Dennis. But talk about that loving, gentle side for a young boy who was on his deathbed. Seeing your husband step up, not just in a hospital, but to the world that was watching, because what happened to your son became a global phenomenon. And for the young people that are not familiar with the story, they won't understand what you had to face as parents when you walked outside of a hospital, when you left your home, when it was the Kardashian moment before there was Kardashians, the phenomenon that you faced was unprecedented.
We didn't really know what happened to Matt when we left Saudi, when we got the word that he'd been found and was unconscious and not expected to survive. So when we found out that all the press was gathering, it was a totally foreign thing to us, but it was also secondary. We just had to get there to be with Matt. And when we got to the hospital, his physicians were like, "We know you're scared. We know you're upset. But when you go into Matt's room, please try to remain positive and calm. Don't show your fear or your anger, because we know that those emotions may translate to Matt, even though he's unconscious." So we made every effort to make it feel comfortable for him. Played his music, familiar smells, scents, my perfume he bought for me, stories. And Dennis just felt that his rabbit, Oscar, we the one thing that would make it better. We all felt so helpless. Right, that we just had to do something, right? So Dennis drove 5 hours home, tore the storage unit apart looking for the rabbit, and didn't find it. But he found other things that he felt would be comforting to Matt. But it was just this sense of, I have to do something, right? I can't just watch, that overtook Dennis. And he was so angry at the senselessness of it all. And we just had to figure out how to not communicate that to Matt. Oh. There were actually a lot of family and friends that came to be with us while Matt was still in the hospital. And of course, we let them go visit him, right? That was about him, not us. So that helped us and them and Matt, I think, I hope.
When you started putting the pieces together of what exactly did happen, And knowing that the perpetrators didn't have parents like you and Dennis, didn't have these beautiful, loving hearts. And as you learned the details, can you share what that was like with our audience as a mother when you're hearing the recap of your son's final hours and days on this planet, and how horrific it actually was?
It was really confusing. I've never understood that level of hate. I don't understand it, that they would feel that much anger and hate towards something that they didn't understand, that they feared even. I do think of it that way. I think that's what it is. It's a fear of something you don't understand. And so it creates this anger and sometimes leads to violence. If those two boys and their bullying when they were young, especially the Aaron McKinney, if that had been addressed when he was a young man, he might have been a totally different person. But it was not. Bullies are bullies for a reason. We need to address that reason, or things that would happen to Matt will continue to happen. Zero tolerance in schools just doesn't work. They came from broken homes. Many people come from broken homes and are wonderfully successful and loving and kind people. But these two young men had a childhood that was terrible. It was awful. And one was from a bad home and the other lost his mom at a very young age. And he just went wild, and no one know what to do about him. Is like, that does not give you the right to do what you did to my son. And for the reasons that you did it, that makes no sense to me. And then when the trials were over and we knew that Aaron was facing the death penalty, his defense team approached us and said, would you consider the same sentencing for him as the other young man who had pled guilty if we remove all appeals? And I said, I have to talk it over with everybody else. I wanted to do it because I wanted it to be over. But I also understood that this isn't going to solve anything. But the reason I wanted to go for the deal was I didn't want our other son, Logan, to deal with constant appeals, mandatory appeals to the death penalty. And there's always the option, right, that some technicality is going to play an absurdly large role. And I didn't want that option either. So, and anyone who thinks it was merciful to remove the death penalty doesn't really think about what it feels like for a 20-year-old to be imprisoned for two lifetimes, right? This is not mercy, but it is over. We don't ever have to deal with them again. So that part is good. But we've lost our beautiful son, and their families lost their sons. And it wasn't just our life that was altered forever, but theirs as well, and their friends. And it was a tragedy all around, a totally senseless tragedy all around.
What has it been like for you as the story has unfolded? There's documentaries and films, an exquisite play that a lot of high schools use. What is it like for you to have that story come back to life? And it's not entertainment, it's more information and a call to action. But what is that like for you as a parent to see those stories come back to life?
Well, the documentary is particularly hard because there he is in front of you, alive and well and happy. And then in the end, he's gone again. We can't watch it. You just can't do it. I mean, we've done it a dozen times, I'm sure, but it just gets harder and harder every time. I keep thinking, I'm okay with this. I can deal with this. I can't. I really can't. Laramie Project, I saw it the first time all the way through 10 years later. I just couldn't do it. There's a thing called Considering Matthew Shepard. It's an oratorio, same thing. It tells the story of Matt and his beautiful music. I just can't do it. It's just real. I can talk about Matt till everybody wishes I would stop, but to actually visualize it is really hard. Really hard. I'm thrilled that those things are out there so people get to know Matt in a different way than reading about him as a young person who was murdered because he was gay. They see him as a three-dimensional human being, but it's really hard for us to watch.
The stark images, you know, I think of when I taught this story is always the fence in Wyoming.
Yeah.
Have you and Dennis gone to that fence? Was that something that you needed to see firsthand, or is it just through photographs? And for our young authors and watchers who don't know about the fence, can you talk about how that played such an important role in this hate crime?
Well, it's a buck rail fence, which picture the fences that we all just talked about, Abe Lincoln building, was that kind of fence. It's used in ranches and particularly among areas where there's a lot of game hunting. The two young men had tied Matt to the bottom of this fence as they beat him and tied his hands to the bottom pole as he was sitting on the ground. Tied up, they were beating him. But to go to the fence, Dennis went to see it, but I did not. I knew Matt was not there. I didn't need to see it to know what happened and to feel the anguish, but Dennis did feel the need to go. Before the trials had even started, that piece of property was sold and the fence was dismantled. You can't even go near it now. There is a no trespassing sign strung across the dirt road that leads to it. The new owner did not want it to become a memorial site. That's fine with me. There is a memorial bench on the University of Wyoming campus in Laramie. And it took a long time for me to even to agree to do that because I was so worried about vandalism. That would have been like murdering Matt all over again. But it is in a safe and secure place, and they're always finding flowers and notes there. So it was a good thing.
When you said murdering Matt again, I can only imagine folks who've taken out their ire and their hate and directed towards you and your husband. Having been on the other end with the Freedom Riders, when we've received death threats and when we've received hate mail, it's devastating. What is that like for you to have been a recipient of that kind of hatred?
It's just nonsense. I couldn't take any of that personally. I knew it was their own hatred trying to identify itself and garner attention. The Westboro Baptist Church was like the worst of them all, just filled with hate. I knew I was right and they were wrong. I wasn't going to give them any power. And I ignored them all. I know it's still out there. We still get hate mail and calls occasionally at the office in Denver, but it's just, we all know it's weak. I never feared for my own personal safety. I know it was a concern at some colleges when I would speak. I just didn't give it any power. Did it hurt me? No. I felt bad for them that their lives were so enveloped in hate that they would never know the joy of love the way I did. So it's their loss.
When you evoke the Westboro Baptist Church, they're at every pride parade I've ever attended with their megaphones and their signs. And children, oh, I hate when I see them having children with their handmade signs. So as a loving mother who experienced joy and love, what is that like when you've been at these protests and you see these kids who are being taught to hate where you taught Matt to love?
In my view, their view of God is a very demeaning, demanding, cruel God. And that is not at all what I was brought up to believe. I didn't come from a religious family, but I learned that from my friends and my parents, that is not what any of us thought what that was about. And I felt just terrible grief and pain for the loss those kids were experiencing, but they didn't know that they weren't experiencing love. In their household, that's how they experienced love, was to share this story of how much God hates pretty much everything, as near as I could tell. I know there have been family members who have left. They didn't know until they left what they were missing, in my view. They were learning something completely different. I feel bad for them. I think that they've been denied their childhood. How can anyone else relate to that childhood, right? It's just beyond me how that happens. I've never understood the anger. And when I was talking about my mom being a bigot, I made a very conscious decision at the age of 8 that that was not going to be my life. But she learned it from her parents and so on and so on. And that's where this hate and prejudice comes from. It is taught from generation to generation. And it's choice. That's really the only thing here that is a choice.
You know, I'm glad you're saying that because so many of our listeners are youthful. And I love that, you know, at age 8, you made a conscious choice. I'm not going to be a bigot. I'm not going to be prejudiced. And I would hope that some of our listeners could do the same. Listening to you as a mother's love and realize I have my own volition, my own choices to make, and I don't have to espouse the stuff that my parents espouse. Which leads me to your activism. You mentioned earlier James Byrd Jr. And for the young folk who don't know who James Byrd Jr. was, it was around the time that your son was murdered. James Byrd was tied to a pickup truck in Texas and dragged behind a car, an African-American. And what you were able to do with James Byrd Jr.'s family sparked a revolution. So can you tell our listeners what you did that was just amazing as parents who were hurting and wanting to heal, but wanting this to stop?
In the civil rights movement in the 60s, there was a hate crime law that was introduced that covered race, religion, and national origin. It was very narrow. It had to occur during a protected event like voting or going to school. The hate crimes, that's how hate crimes were defined. However, when James Byrd Jr. was murdered in Texas, he was murdered on a public road. So existing hate crime laws, federal laws, did not cover his crime. And Texas had no hate crime laws then. And when Matt was murdered, the federal hate crime law did not cover sexual orientation. And Wyoming, and which Wyoming still doesn't have, is a hate crime law at all. So when Matt was killed and James Byrd was killed, there was added to an already movement that was happening to expand federal hate crime laws. The bills had been introduced and so forth even before those two events happened. But there was trouble getting it through Congress because they wanted to include the LGBT community. And Congress was like, no, we're not going to do that. Luckily, the writers of the bill were not going to take out the gay community because they knew hate crimes were being committed against the gay community. So I joined with other organization leaders to speak before Congress, the Senate Judiciary Committee. They lobbied. I was a terrible lobbyist because I had no patience. I thought y'all went there to do the right thing and you're not doing the right thing. So I had no patience for them. In the Clinton administration, when I joined, he did what he sometimes does, which is give it a lot of lip service and then not really accomplish much. Bush administration, George W., we knew he was not ever going to sign anything that would advance the gay community. As governor of Texas, we'd already seen that. He said he would not sign any hate crime legislation that included the gay community because he just didn't think, you know, they were real. It was a choice to him. But when Obama was elected, all us quote unquote social justice warriors felt that we had the man in the office now who could really help us accomplish these necessary humanitarian things. And in October 2009, Obama signed into law the federal hate crime bill that now covers gender identity and expression, the gay community, disability, gender, expands the parameters of when a hate crime can be committed. It doesn't fix everything because it doesn't require reporting, which is absolutely necessary for law enforcement to tell us where these things are happening, to be able to address the issue. But just recently, I will add that there was an additional hate crime law passed to address the hate crimes being committed against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders that now requires reporting in certain cases, which is better than what it was before, but also provides money for training for law enforcement. So, you know, we're in a better place than we were last year. Yeah. So, you know, I lobbied. Well, I didn't lobby. I couldn't go office to office and talk to them because they just lied to me. So I had an alliance with Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts and Senator Smith from Oregon, a Republican Mormon who was with the gay community in every aspect because he regarded it as a human right. He said he would never be with us with marriage, which I understood as a Mormon, but the rest of it was, to him, it was a human right. It was for the betterment of U.S. citizens. Where did we lose that knowledge? Where did we lose that figure of speech that it was like for all Americans, not my party, right? Where did that go?
As a foundation, what Matthew Shepard does for the world is it keeps people accountable. So whenever there's something wrong, your foundation was vigilant. You gave data and statistics and numbers, and you really come out to fight for the trans community, which I think is so exquisite when young people were being denied just simple things of going to the bathroom at schools and equity. So as this foundation has grown, and now that Logan is older and a part of this foundation, the whole family, what is it like to be on the forefront of being on the right side of history?
It's glorious to see that the bulk of the country wants to be on the right side of history too. I think there are far more of us who want to see that. It's just that we're not quite as loud, and we need to be loud. We all have a voice. We all should be using it. And please vote. Y'all need to vote. Be an educated voter. I say that till I can't say it anymore. It's really important that we pay attention to what's going on. And the fact that the trans community finally has a language to describe who they are and what they are, that the rest of us can try to understand, that we can try to be involved in their progression towards equality, is really important to me. When I first started this, the language that was inherent to the trans community just didn't exist. And now it does. And we also know that it has always existed. We just didn't know how to describe it or how to fight for it. And now we do. The foundation work has always been about all the marginalized communities. Race issues, feminist issues, the trans community, part of the gay community. Some of the gay organizations 20 plus years ago didn't even acknowledge the trans community as being part of what they were fighting for. And that was really an issue, a big issue back then. And now I feel like we're all getting on the same page here. But we all know that hate crimes statistically pick up when there's a positive step forward. So we've seen hate crimes rise against the gay community. During Pride Month in particular, they just skyrocket. And they're targeting trans folks now in particular because that's the last bastion of, you know, denying equality. And everyone knows that they have lost that war against all the marginalized communities. The hard part now is going to be to implement what we know is right and to codify it into law and get away from executive orders that can be changed in a heartbeat. We need to codify this stuff in law. And to be sending human rights to the Supreme Court, please, let's not do that anymore. Let's codify it into law.
Mm. You know, I've been in audiences before where you'll say something and I'll look at somebody and we'll whisper, oh my God, did she just say that? Like, you say what everybody wants to say and you have the guts to say it. Does that ever get you into trouble, or do you feel spontaneous, like standing ovations or applause? Because you say what you feel rather than, you know, doing a Gallup poll or being politically correct. I just think you've got this, like, this gut and grit that's some part of your personality that I'm envious of, not having that kind of gumption when I'm in a room full of people.
I do have to rein in Dennis occasionally because he would get us in trouble. But I don't know how to bend things. I just feel like honesty is the best policy. I'm just saying what I think is wrong or right. I present my remarks always in the notion that this is my opinion. This is what I think. You know, if I get in trouble, I get in trouble. I just cannot tone down what I know is absolutely wrong. I've even gone so far as to drop the F-bomb a couple of times. And it's like, that probably should have got me in trouble.
That's my favorite part. I was in the audience when the F-bomb was dropped. And it was like, I think we stamped our feet and we hooted and hollered and thought, this is glorious.
It makes me so angry that I really think everybody knows that what's going on is wrong. And especially in the previous administration, we knew it was wrong. But did we do anything about it except complain to our friends? Probably not. Did we even vote? Maybe. And in the election of 2016, we knew it was going to be a disaster if the wrong one won and the wrong one won, and it was a disaster. Everything we knew was going to happen happened. But did we go to vote? No. We thought, oh, it's a cinch. It is not a cinch. It's never a cinch. We cannot ever neglect our duty to vote. It's our duty. So, yes, I will say what's on my mind, and I will continue to say what's on my mind. And I'm a Wyoming girl. We don't know how to do anything else.
I spent a lot of time with a wonderful Holocaust survivor named Renee Firestone, and her righteous indignation politically aligns with your righteous indignation politically, because she felt there was a lot of deja vu moments. And what she would put out in the universe is, I've seen this before, I've lived this before, and this is coming.
Yep.
And then it was the I told you so. And I wonder for you if you had that same kind of deja vu feeling of, I've felt this before, I've lived this before, and then these horrible things would happen. And you had to look around and say, I told you so. The sky was going to fall and it fell. Was that hard for you?
Yes, it was. I'm a product of the 60s, right? So I lived through that very turbulent decade. I was very young. I graduated from high school in 70. So I'm old now, but I lived through that. And even living through it in Wyoming, I saw the horror of the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War and the assassinations of our country's leaders and just this chaos of not knowing what to do next, not knowing how we were going to organize and make it right. And then follow that up with Nixon. Oh my God, what were we thinking? It was definitely, I've been here before. We cannot let this happen again. We just stopped paying attention and began to take everything for granted that our government people were good because they were running for office. That is not how it works. It's not how it works. We assumed that right was going to win over. Well, it did eventually, but we went through a lot of garbage before we got here, and we're still dealing with trauma and the aftermath of that garbage, and we will be for years. For the first time in a decade, high school students were polled about their feelings of the LGBTQ community, and the positivity declined. Declined. We take our attitudes from leadership. And when we see our leadership espousing that hate and that racism and bigotry, we began to think, oh, well, maybe that's the way it should be. No, it isn't the way it should be. And he uncorked all the hate that had been pushed down by public opinion, peer pressure, saying it was wrong, and now it's all out there again. Are we glad we know at least where it's at now, or do we wish it was corked up again? It'll never be corked up again. It's out there now. Mm. We just can't stop watching and paying attention. Can't take it for granted ever again, ever again.
When you channel Matthew's, it's a mandate. It's a mandate and a mission. I love at your core, you had such a beautiful foundation. Like just love, joy emanating from him. How do you take that joy and that love and try to rock other folks' foundation that doesn't have that as a core attribute? So how do you spread love and how do you spread joy in your son's mission and mandate?
I truly believe you can only change hearts and minds with stories. And when Dennis and I, or anybody from the foundation who has been asked to tell the story of Matt or the work that we do, we try to make it clear that the work that we do is rooted in love, and peace. And we're only going to get there if we root out those who are against it, who don't want to be in that world. Who wouldn't, in their best day, or maybe even in their worst day, want to be in a world of light and peace and happiness and acceptance of their fellow man? I do not want to live in a world of darkness where I have to fear for who I am as a woman, as an older woman, as an activist for the gay community. I want to be surrounded by love and understanding and patience and compassion, not anger and hate. And I just don't think we're going to get there unless we all share our own stories of our pain when we have been forced to encounter that hate and how we have survived it.
So is there a specific story that when you think of your son that isn't offense, isn't a hospital bed, it isn't feeling vulnerable and helpless, that when you think of Matthew, that you want the world to think of, because that will allow others to go back and share stories with their loved ones.
When Matt was in grade school, back in the day when schools still had Halloween costume parades, for 2 years in a row, fifth and sixth grade, Matt was Dolly Parton. He just thought that she was so outrageously out there, and he loved country music. He was a, forgive the term, closeted country music fan, but he just loved everything about her. And I had these old maternity shirts, and for some reason we had this wig, and he would put balloons in the blouse and be Dolly Parton. And every year, and the fifth grade was his first year, but the sixth grade, he really had it down. And his teachers were all commenting on how fun it was that he wanted to be Dolly Parton for Halloween. All those years ago, a lot of the boys were costumed as female characters because they were easy to imitate, I guess, costume-wise. There wasn't the stigma on it then that there, unfortunately, is now. But he loved it, and they loved it, and it was very fun. It was a moment where he was very free and very happy. And it tapped into his theatrical tendencies, right? So it was great.
Do you find yourself feeling like, I feel like throughout this amazing interview, what you haven't seen, what I see, is there's these moments of like almost like blinding lights. And I know the sun is peeking through in your Wyoming home right now, but I sort of feel every time that you become illuminated that it's Matt in the room. So are there moments where you do feel him?
Yes, there are. And you may think I'm weird for saying this, but whenever I'm doing my, I don't know what to call them, lectures, programs, whatever, at a college or an employee resource group or whatever, wherever I am, I never prepare anything, ever. But I know that when I get in front of the microphone, I know exactly what I'm going to say. Mm. And I always feel like Matt is coaching me, because Dennis and I both feel like we're doing the work he would be doing if he were still here. The core of the message always comes when we're in front of the microphone. Always.
And it's always unique, and it's always inspiring. And I've always used the word when I describe you, that you're channeling him. I feel that it's just that, like you said, it's this effortless moment that puts everybody at ease. But the fact that you don't have notes, that you don't use a teleprompter, that it's not scripted, is so genuine. And I think people need that genuine connection with him and with you and a cause. It's truly a gift. It's truly a gift.
These people in front of me didn't come here to see me read something. Even if I'm doing it on a teleprompter, I'm still reading it, right? You can't, it never felt real to me. And I, of all the ones, lectures I have been to in my life, the ones that have lasted have been the ones where the people just talk to me. Just talk to me, you know, make me feel at ease. And the highest compliment I ever get from my programs are, I didn't know Mrs. Shepherd could be funny.
Oh, you're hysterical.
I don't know, they go expecting some, you know, I'm going to be crying through the whole thing or angry or whatever, but that just, I know they're not going to listen to me if that's all I have to say. And I am funny, damn it.
So I have two last questions for you. Sure. One is piggybacking off what you just said. You've got this captive audience of educators, their family, and their students. If you could talk to the young boy in fifth and sixth grade who wants to dress up of whatever icon there is now, whether it's a Dolly Parton then or a Gal Gadot as Wonder Woman now, if you could just talk to me, i.e. that boy, getting ready for Halloween and thinking about their costume, speak to that kid first, where he feels like Judy Shepherd, talk to me.
Just be yourself. Don't let anybody else tell you who you should be. Even at the age of 10, people telling you who you should be or what they want from you is not going to positively affect your life. It may give you ideas, for sure, or goals that you want to do. But having someone dictate to you who you should be or how you should live your life is not the path to follow. You need to follow what is in your heart. Because that is the only way you will ever feel fulfilled, is to do what is in your heart and in your mind. What makes you happy? What do you want to achieve? What are your hopes and goals? And ask yourself that every day of your life.
So I was truly channeling your son and your life's work. I think my last question to you is, if you were able to speak directly to Matt, which I know you do every moment of every day, where you're not channeling him, now you're channeling a mother's love and devotion. What would you channel to your son that is only to your son? And we, for a moment, get to be voyeuristic and see that love and devotion and truly understand what love looks like.
Well, Matt, you made it. You're famous. You're famous. We all love you. We miss you like the Dickens. To see what you have accomplished. I don't like to see you be Dolly Parton today. I just wish you were here.
I'm so grateful to our guest, Judy Shepherd, for bravely standing up against hate and prejudice of any kind. My dear listeners, may each of us look for ways to eliminate hate. May we all inspire individuals, organizations, and communities to embrace the dignity and equality of all people. And in Matthew's honor, may we provide everyone with mutual respect and authentic love. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Gruwell. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.